May it please the court, good afternoon, your honors. The trial court erred in this case by imposing a remedy for breaches of fiduciary duty and a statutory violation that required all the minority shareholders to pay money and send in a form to participate in the case. Let me first turn to the standard of review. The remedy ruling in this case was made on summary judgment, and our position is that the same standard of review that's applicable, as far as I know, to every appeal of every summary judgment decision should apply here, which is de novo. But in the event that there's a more lenient standard of review, even if it's abuse of discretion, that standard of review is satisfied, or we've met that in this case. And let me explain why. And this is really the heart of...
Mr. Brown, before you do that, I just want to jump to the bottom line to make sure I know where this is heading. Is it your position that if we agree on the merits with your argument that the case should be remanded to proceed as a Weinberger type class action?
Yes. Right. And I can let me clarify that a little bit. The really all we're talking about is we're not talking about rescissory damages or some exotic relief. We're just saying the remedy in this case should be the payment of the difference between the merger price and fair value to all of the minority shareholders, not just those who paid back $2 and sent in a form.
Right. So there's nothing to compute as far as the measure of damages. It's just the question is who is entitled to the damages.
I think that's exactly correct, Your Honor. The way it's going to work is that some people opted in to the case, including my client. So if this is affirmed, a small group of people or a relatively small, modest number of shares will be paid the difference between the merger price and fair value as calculated by the court. If we prevail in this appeal, everyone, all the minority shareholders, would be entitled to that payment. That's really what this is about.
Now, well, since we've interrupted your flow, as I understand it, the chancellor said, well, we're going to give everybody notice and a chance to request money, but we're not going to give everybody money unless they ask for it. Is that right?
Correct.
And so now you're going to tell us why that was not a good solution.
Exactly. And it wasn't just a chance to request money. It's more than just an opt-in class action. You actually have to pay money to get into the case. You have to send back a portion of the merger consideration, which was, to me, and I want to get to my core of my point, but it was extremely odd because this is an unusual case. The controlling shareholder does not contend that the merger price was fair. So there's no risk. If there had been an appraisal case, there'd be no risk that people would lose the $20. So requiring people to send back money is just, it's almost punitive. It's almost nonsensical under the facts of this case. But the core of my argument is really what happened here was the chancellor tried to recreate what was taken, what he perceived as having been taken from the minority shareholders, their right to demand appraisal following a short-form merger. And if what the trial court should have been doing was try to recreate what they had, their appraisal rights, I don't think I would be here complaining. My point is that's the wrong objective or goal. That's not what the remedy should be focused on. We're not trying to, in a case like this, in a fiduciary duty violation, statutory violation case, give back to the minority what they were taken. Their claim, the fiduciary duty of disclosure claim, doesn't include reliance, causation, and damage elements. And
if somebody was making the choice whether to opt in, assuming that choice has been given to them, and they believe that $21 is actually the fair value, and that's where the case is headed, they've got 20. When all is said and done, what are they going to get with attorney's fees and costs and everything else? What's the practical effect of opting in under that scenario?
Well, it depends how many shares they'd get. They'd get the difference between, if it's $21, they get another dollar a share, less whatever fees are awarded by the court.
Okay. Well, my point is there a scenario where they may get net less than 20?
No.
There's not?
No. Okay. We would not ask for the only way they can get less money is the fees come out of the recovery. And we can't, I wouldn't be asking for fees, and we certainly couldn't ask for fees for getting, we only can ask for the fees for the amount we recover, which is the amount in excess of $20 a share.
Well, let me just ask you a practical question using numbers that have nothing to do with this case. You talked about why should you send in the money and then get money back, which suggests there's some lag time. But it appears that if everything worked in a perfect world and I was entitled to $120, but the merger consideration was $100, I'd give you my check for $100, I'd get a check back instantly for $120, and it's just paperwork. And what you're saying is if that's the way it should work under the circumstances of this case, why make the person send in the $100? Just give them the $20 difference.
Yes. And why send in a form? I mean, traditionally, these cases are all not opt-in class actions. Everyone's entitled to be paid the same per share price, so they're always handled as not opt-in class actions.
Well, and the purpose of my question is, if I gave you a check for $100 and you gave me a check for $120, and we did that, you know, instantly, we get to the same point almost as if you just gave me the $20 difference. And you seem to be saying that what the chancellor's done is so far afield from this check exchange I've described in my hypothetical that it's not fair.
That's certainly one way of looking at it. My point, too, though, Your Honor, is in addition to that, what we're doing here is not recreating appraisal. We're trying to take from the controlling shareholder who did a transaction with a minority what they gained, because that's the purpose here. It's if you do a transaction with your minority shareholders and you acquire their stock and you don't discharge your fiduciary duty of loyalty and you violate the appraisal statute, what really is happening is you're saying, well, whether people would have demanded appraisal or not doesn't really matter, because you, the fiduciary, doesn't get to keep that benefit, the windfall, the profit, whatever you want to call it, from the transaction. If you do a transaction with your minority shareholders like this, you know, you under these circumstances, with this level of stock holdings, you don't have to pay a fair price, you don't have to act in a fair manner, but you do have two obligations, which one is make full disclosure, and that derives from your duty of loyalty, and comply with the appraisal statute. And if you don't do that, you don't get what the law would otherwise let you get, which is the difference between, you know, acquire the shares on a bargain price, bargain basis, for less than they're worth. So
your last comment suggests that there's more to this than simply not complying with the appraisal statute.
Yes, Your Honor.
What's the nature of the breach of the duty of loyalty?
Well, as was found here, there's a violation of the appraisal statute, failure to include a correct copy of the appraisal statute, and a failure to disclose all material facts. That's separate from appraisal, the appraisal statute. That's a judicially imposed obligation, as was discussed in Arnold and other cases.
The appraisal statute itself doesn't require that you disclose how you came to the number in the short.
That was not my understanding. That obligation to disclose all the material facts is a fiduciary duty that's a corollary to the statutory obligations under 262. All 262 says is provide them with a copy of the appraisal statute. So that there's a fiduciary duty, and that's what it says in Glassman versus Unical, that fiduciary obligation, it's the only one really that you have in a short form merger, is the disclosure obligation. And where does it derive from? I my understanding was, you know, it depending on the circumstances, it's care or loyalty, and where you have a controlling shareholder who's taking out the minority, it's the duty of loyalty that gives rise to the obligation to give them the information they need. You know, I'm going to tell them I'm going to probably be trying to acquire your shares for less than they're worth. You know, here's the information you need to make your investment decision about what to do.
Mr. Brown, stepping back for a minute and looking at the bigger picture, is it your view that in granting the remedy that he did, the chancellor was acting out of a belief that that's what the law required, or are we talking about a discretionary exercise here?
Well, I don't think it was a discretionary exercise. I believe he, you know, the actual text of the opinion says that he finds this case to be governed by Gilliland. So it, my interpretation of the opinion is that he thought
the law required
this was the law. This is the way the law had developed. And that brings me to the next point. Let me discuss the cases and what the law is, or at least what my understanding of what the law was. There's really three cases that are pretty close here that deal with this, either this exact situation or components of it. The first is Niebel versus Southwest Bancorp. That was a short form merger just like this one. The only violation found was the failure to provide the correct copy of the appraisal statute, and the remedy was the payment of the difference between the merger price and fair value to all the minority. I didn't think that was controversial. That flows from the fundamental rule that I just discussed, that if you're a controlling shareholder and you're taking out the minority and you don't comply with your obligations, you don't get to keep the bonus, the difference between the merger price and fair value. So there's Niebel. Wacht versus Continental Hosts, it didn't involve a statutory violation. It involved a pure fiduciary duty of disclosure violation. I think that was the only wrong found in that case. It was exactly the same fiduciary duty of disclosure violation here, the failure to disclose how the controlling shareholder had arrived at the merger price. And the remedy there was the payment of the difference between the merger price and fair value. So those cases each has a component of the wrongs here. We have them both. So if I don't think it makes sense to have those cases out there awarding that remedy and then say in this case, which has the complete package, you don't get the same remedy. It doesn't make sense to me.
Let's go back to the disclosure violation, which according to our cases only arises when you ask for shareholder action. Here, because of the ownership level, they could cash the minority out, but they had a duty to disclose the value because the action was either take the merger consideration or ask for an appraisal. And it's that breach of fiduciary duty in the context of those choices of actions that leads to this remedy you're arguing for.
Exactly. And, you know, the cases do say, you see the language, obviously, Your Honor, that you owe a fiduciary duty of disclosure when you seek shareholder action. I think if you look through all the cases, putting people in the position of demanding appraisal is viewed as seeking shareholder action, or it's a form of putting a decision to your beneficiary shareholder. So that's sort of, even though it doesn't fit exactly within the words seek shareholder action, it's part of that group of activities that's contemplated by that. The last case, and really the one that caused the problem here, I think, or that led to the error, what we contend is the error, is Gilliland versus Motorola. It's a very unique case. It was a controlling shareholder transaction, but it was a two-step transaction. Motorola didn't own 90%. It made an unsolicited tender offer for the minority shares of Next Level Communications. A special committee was created, opposed the tender offer. There was massive litigation. The price was ultimately negotiated up. There were numerous investment banker opinions from the Motorola side and the special committee side. And the tender offer ultimately went through. Litigation was resolved. They got up to 90% as a result of the tender offer, effected a short-form merger. Another case was filed that said the disclosure that came out in the appraisal notice to follow the short-form merger, all of which happened within a period of a few weeks, basically, said that notice, the appraisal notice, was defective because it didn't include either some new additional information or restate other material information that had previously been disclosed in connection with the tender offer. The trial court said, all right, well, this is a technical, very technical claim because everything's already been disclosed. There's already been litigation in which Vice Chancellor Lamb found that everything was already disclosed on the front-end tender offer. He carefully went through all the cases and ultimately concluded that although it's technical, you can't just send out an appraisal notice that says absolutely nothing at all. You at least have to tell people, because shares could have been bought and sold, you know, where filings are that include the material information, have some summary information, guidance in it, versus just a plain piece of paper that just says you have appraisal rights, here's the appraisal statute. So in that case, the court, given that technical violation, came up with a remedy that's essentially the same remedy that applies here. We'll let everyone demand appraisal again. The court did say to the defendants in the case, what is it you're going to contend fair value is? Because I'm only going to make the people who want to opt in or who, to this remedy I'm creating pay what they potentially could lose. You don't have to give back the whole merger consideration.
Is Gilliland, in your view, can it be distinguished from Neville?
Yes. I mean,
let me ask you differently. Was Gilliland properly decided, and if so, how is it different from Neville?
Well, I think I'm familiar with both cases, having been involved in litigation. Gilliland, I think, was incorrectly decided. I mean, to me, it's very simple. It's the same rule. If there's a fiduciary duty of disclosure violation, there, you, the controlling shareholder, shouldn't get to keep the difference. Now, in Gilliland, though, there wasn't really any argument that it was an unfair price. It was a highly negotiated transaction. I mean, it's not like this case or like Neble, where it was apparent that the price was unfair. In Neble, the merger price was, I think, $41 a share. The ultimate valuation was 80,
85,
in the vicinity of $85 a share. And you could look at the valuation, the way it was done, and tell that this was not a fair, I mean, it was a very difficult argument that it might be a fair price. It was looked like a controlling shareholder trying to get rid of the minority.
So, in that respect, Gilliland could be distinguished from Neville. That is, that because the price had been heavily negotiated, it was at least presumptively fair, as distinguished from Neville.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so one could read the disposition, that is, the remedy that was ordered in Gilliland, as being an exercise of discretion as opposed to the application of some rule or mandate.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. And I think you will, if you actually look at Gilliland, I believe one of the items that the Vice Chancellor pointed out was just what you said. Neville appeared to be, you know, an unfair price case. It looked really unfair. And in Gilliland, it didn't. That's not what was the issue.
I should let you know that you're into your rebuttal. Decide whether you want to go on or not.
Unless Your Honors have any other questions, I've made my basic argument. I'll save my 7 minutes for reply.
And I won't use your time to tell you that we will actually look at Gilliland.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. The issue here is whether or not the Chancellor abused his discretion in fashioning quasi-appraisal relief.
Tell us why that's the standard of review, given all of our cases that say on summary judgment we do it de novo. Why shouldn't the remedy be part of the de novo review?
The reason, Justice Holland, that this Court has given weight to the exercise of discretion by the Chancery Court is that after a violation has been found, the court in equity is to discharge equitable principles to determine the appropriate remedy. And thus it would seem that court is best able to evaluate the case, the facts, and determine what is the appropriate remedy. And it would seem to me that based upon that standard, this Court has said that where the Court of Chancery fashions relief, it will accord weight to the discretion of the Chancellor and hold the Chancellor to the responsibility of explaining the basis and the logic of the decision, and the responsibility not to make an error of application of law. And I think that's a very useful standard for the court to apply in this case, particularly since quasi-appraisal is, in fact, somewhat of a nebulous term. It is applied, frankly, where it is essentially too late to have the actual appraisal. In other words, the merger has occurred. And therefore, there should be a certain amount of discretion in the trial court in determining, in light of the situation, what is the appropriate remedy.
Well, Mr. Terrell, if one starts out with the premise that the remedy here has to be some form of quasi-appraisal, then I suppose the form of quasi-appraisal that was granted, whether or not proper, would be a discretionary question. But here, the argument, as I understand it, is that quasi-appraisal was not an appropriate remedy as a matter of law. That is, that as a matter of law, the consequence of the violation here had to be that this case, you know, fell outside the rubric of Glassman and went back into the Weinberger line of cases, so that as a matter of law, because of the disclosure violation, you know, the only remedy that could be granted would be to remand for the case to proceed as a class action, a Weinberger class action, on behalf of the minority. That would be an issue of law, would it not? That is, whether or not that contention is right.
Justice Jacobs, I think it is correct that if the issue that the court focuses on is coming before it is whether or not to have applied quasi-appraisal standard here or some other standard, would seem to be an issue of law such that I think it does fall within, if you will, the exception to the exercise of discretion by the trial court. Namely, did the trial court err as a matter of law in fashioning relief? I'd be happy then to turn to, I think, the corollary of Your Honor's question, which would be, in my mind, was it appropriate for the court to apply quasi-appraisal remedy here? One quick answer is I think the parties essentially agreed that it was quasi-appraisal remedy. As His Honor's opinion below points out, the parties differed in implementing the quasi-appraisal remedy. And that's expressly set forth in the opinion below. But more importantly, it seems to me, Your Honor, this case was brought as a breach of fiduciary duty of disclosure, not a breach of any duty of loyalty, not a breach of some fraud. Obviously, 253 gives a 90% stockholder the absolute right to determine the price and timing of any such merger. The violation of 253 here was found by the court below, and it's not on appeal, is clearly that the drafters of the notice that went out to the stockholders failed to include the most recent amendment in the past 7 months to the statute and did not disclose how the merger price was arrived at by the 90% stockholder. Now, while the statute doesn't require such disclosure, my friend, the appellant, was successful in persuading the trial court that it should have been disclosed. And I think the Watt case, decided a number of years ago, supports his argument, though that case was in the context
well, not
the
just
251 merger.
Not just the Watt case, but the Glassman case.
That's right. I think it started with Watt, but you're absolutely right, Your Honor, and I don't want to misspeak on that. So in essence, this is a case of, if you will, inadvertent failure to disclose all that that should have been in the notice. That's not at issue.
Well, the failure to the mess up in terms of the appraisal statute may have been inadvertent, but are you telling us that the non-disclosure of any facts as to how the price was arrived at was inadvertent?
I think that would be perhaps an exaggeration on my part. There was no finding one way or another by the trial court. There certainly has been no evidence that there was any intent to deceive the stockholders, and since whomever drafted the notice didn't realize that case law would expect that to be set forth, the notice does explain the, if you will, trading history in the stock, though there was, of course, limited trading. It was over the counter. And when the corrected notice came out, Your Honor, the corrected notice explained that essentially the way in which the merger price was arrived at was that this stockholder looked at the trading practice and rounded up the number to $20 per share. There was no investment bank.
Are you saying that the majority stockholder did disclose how the price was arrived at? I thought that it was a given for this case that was not disclosed.
He did not, Your Honor, and I only pointed out when it was disclosed in the corrected notice, it certainly did not show that there was any formal valuation that would have told the 90% stockholder that indeed the value of this company was such and such. It explained his really, if you will, almost unsophisticated way of coming up with a merger price. I think that's as far as I can go as a matter of record in trying to answer Your Honor's question.
But as a matter of policy, we have this situation where when you own more than 90%, you can do certain things. But one of them is superimposed as your fiduciary duty that when you ask for shareholder action, which is either take the merger consideration or elect an appraisal, you have to disclose to them what would be material to their decision-making process. And it's agreed that was not done in this case.
Justice Holland, that's correct. It's agreed, and I'm looking at it from the point of view of the violation having been determined, what's the appropriate remedy, and the appropriate remedy selected was quasi-appraisal. The parties differ with respect to, if you will, some of the terms.
Well, let's go to the mechanism. If we go back to my hypothetical about exchanging checks, and if it really could happen as an exchange of checks, why not just give them the difference? Why is it equitable to make people incur the time and expense for that fiduciary duty when what we're really saying is the majority controlling 90% shareholder should simply have to pay everybody the difference?
Your Honor, the reason is that the violation here in the 253 context was the failure to disclose certain information. And what the trial court did in relief was to put the stockholders back in the position that they would have been had there been correct disclosure, and made it more favorable for them to make the appraisal election.
Well, you say that, but I guess what I'm having trouble with is why would anybody not want the difference? What the chancellor has said in essence is everybody who wants the difference can now get the difference. They have to just do the paperwork. And when we're talking about equitable remedies, someone could say, well, I've spent the money, I've moved on, I cannot avail myself of the remedy the way the chancellor's crafted it, so I just have to let it go, even though the chancellor's concluded I could get the difference if I had the wherewithal to ask for it.
With due respect, Your Honor, it seems to me the difficulty with that approach that you're hypothesizing is that it essentially is a fairness standard for a breach of the duty of fairness, as opposed to here a breach of the duty to properly disclose what needs to be disclosed for stockholders to elect an appraisal. Because with appraisal, there comes both the election process and the modicum of risk, or the risk that's associated with, but maybe you will not succeed in getting more than the merger price in the quasi-appraisal.
But I understood your opponent to say that there's no risk here, that what attorney's fees would be limited for, to the amount in addition to what was already awarded, and so that there's no possibility of a net loss.
Justice Ridgely, with due respect, I disagree with my opponent on that. I think there is always a risk in an appraisal. That's the reason why we have a process by which the court is would take evidence as to what the value would have been on the merger date, and a stockholder can evaluate whether or not he sees it as risk, what the portion of the risk would be. The stockholder, from reading the appraisal statute, knows that the value could be above or below the merger price, and that he could be, if you will, carrying the costs of that litigation.
But are we beyond that in this case? Because we already know the appraisal price.
With all due respect, I don't think so, Your Honor. This company, PubCo, had two operating companies, a printing business and a construction business. It supplies to both of them. Now, just because on its face you could look to one line in the financial statement and see liquid assets of a certain value, $96 million. But also you look over and you could look at $44 million in liabilities. But more importantly, if and when the appraisal is tried, it is for the trial judge to evaluate the value as of the merger date. And there may be a lot of other factors that are not yet before that court that will go into what the appraisal is. So I think it is premature to judge what the value is. Well, we can all make a guess. Pardon me, Your Honor.
No, Mr. Carroll, just to follow up on Justice Holland's question, let me just walk you through a couple of hypotheticals. Let's assume this case went to a formal appraisal, and your client took the position that not only was the merger price fair, but it was more than fair. That is, it was in excess of what the appraised value would be. In that case, there would be true risk for the shareholder seeking appraisal, correct?
Yes.
All right. The opposite hypothetical would be one where the majority stockholder says, well, I agree that this price is not fair.
That's right.
What then? Certainly there cannot be, in that hypothetical situation, any risk to the minority seeking appraisal that they would get less than the merger price. Or less than the appraised price, because the appraised price would have to be higher than the merger price. Is that right?
That's right. In your hypothetical, you're quite correct, Justice. Okay.
Isn't that this case?
No, with all due respect, no. And let me point out, if I may, that the hypothetical you've given me is very close to Nebel, because by the time the quasi-appraisal came along, there already had been, in a separate action, an appraisal that came up with the $85 per share. So we knew as a matter of law what the appraised value was. That's quite different here when we really don't know. It would be premature to determine what the value is as an absolute matter.
Let me ask my question a little better than I did. Mr. Brown tells us that your client does not contend that the merger price was fair. That's why I asked whether this isn't the second hypothetical.
I do not see, no, I can affirmatively state my client doesn't concede that and has nowhere stated that the price or the value is more than $20 per share. It is true that with some stockholders, obviously, like any litigant, he has reached settlements with some of the stockholders at more than $20 per share. But that's, again, weighing the litigation costs, just as in response to Justice Ridgely's question about, well, what if the value was $21? when it, the stockholder went to sort of weigh whether or not to go through the quasi-appraisal because of the risk of legal fees. So again, I think the beauty of giving the discretion to the trial court to fashion the remedy is that these cases are going to be different, and it's very hard to put one particular mold on a quasi-appraisal case and say, therefore, we're going to say that there is, for example, no opt-in, when, as explained by the trial court below, he saw the appraisal statute as inherently, through the General Assembly passing the appraisal statute, as having a modicum of risk. Now, the trial court didn't say, oh, but it's $2 here. He said, in his opinion, I leave it to counsel to work out a price, and we did.
Mr. Terrell, just to make sure I have your position done correctly, if we were to accept your argument and affirm, and the case then proceeded to a quasi-appraisal, you're telling us that your client would reserve the right to contend in that quasi-appraisal that the fair value of the stock was less than $20, less than the merger price?
Yes, Your Honor. I thought it was useful, perhaps, to the court to try to impart to you that even my friend, the appellant's counsel, has taken the position in this case that the remedy here is better for the stockholders than they would have gotten even under the regular appraisal. Some 6 weeks after the opinion came out and the appellant's counsel moved for fees, he wrote, and it's in the record, the result achieved here was a final injunction requiring new disclosure and setting up a new special appraisal procedure. This is a greater benefit than just additional disclosure. The new appraisal procedure is highly advantageous to former PubCo shareholders. They get to keep most of the merger consideration. Appraisal demands can come from beneficial holders, and they have extra time, 60 days, to get their demands in.
And what legal conclusion do we draw from that?
That the trial court's fashioning the quasi-appraisal remedy here is a fair one to the stockholders in light of the fact that it gave them, in fact, more rights with respect to an appraisal than they had if the 253 merger had done with the correct disclosure originally. And I think when you look at the practicalities of quasi-appraisal litigation or appraisal litigation, the fact that a stockholder keeps 90% of the merger price, it allows that stockholder to have funds, presumably to help subsidize and fund the quasi-appraisal case, which isn't true in a regular 262 appraisal where the stockholders have to essentially come up with all the money. And the fact that the court below went out of its way to give three times the amount of normal time for a stockholder to decide whether to elect appraisal, the fact that it allowed the stockholders to do so street name rather than just through a record owner, and in fact, appellant counsel was perhaps too modest, but he also was able to have the notice tell the stockholders in it that they can contact him and gave his address should the stockholders have any questions. So essentially, this was an attractive vehicle to remedy a simple disclosure violation. I'd be happy to answer any further questions, but I leave you with a reoccurring hope that the court recognizes the importance of affirming here so that the trial court, in trying to do equity, has within it the discretion to weigh all the factors and to reach a fair result. Thank you, Your Honor.
I have one question, Mr. Terrell. In looking at whether Neville more squarely applies here or Gilliland, do we need to know more than what the Chancellor said in his opinion about why he selected Gilliland as the more applicable situation and for the purposes of crafting his remedy?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because I think the court went through a fairly thorough examination in his opinion. And furthermore, I think this court is intimately familiar with the law, such that you can look back to Neville came out in 1995. And as the court below pointed out, really the issue that he, the Chancellor, grappled with in our case was really not ultimately addressed in Neville. As I said, there had already been a separate appraisal with the result known. But maybe even more importantly, after that came the Glassman case of this court, which held that in a 253 merger, there is not a fairness remedy. So in a sense, as I've tried to point out in response to some questions today, I think we should distinguish between the quasi-appraisal remedy here and, if you will, a fairness remedy that automatically applies to all stockholders without them having to take any affirmative action. And I think Glassman supports that approach. So when Gilliland came down in 2005, Your Honor, it was frankly, a little bit more thorough examination in light of the development of the case law. And I don't think we need to try to see factually which case is closer in terms of the actual violation, as it were. I think it is well explained in the decision below how the Chancellor used both cases.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Justice Jacobs, I do want to say where I came up with my statement that the defendants don't contend $20 is fair. Justice Ridgely asked Mr. Terrell at the prior panel argument that question directly, and he conceded it. And then there was a discussion of, well, then why do you have to give back the $2 a share? That's where it came from. But even if he didn't concede it, I mean, this is a company with $36 a share in cash, a $100 million investment company business. The Chancellor held in the opinion, this is a very, very slim appraisal notice in terms of information in it. There's very little information. But part of the reasoning of the Chancellor why other facts weren't material, which we don't agree with, but I don't really think it matters because there was already a disclosure violation found, but was that it was so obvious that this was unfair that you didn't really need any more information. The idea that this company is worth less than $20 a share, even if there hadn't been a concession, which there was at the last argument, is just not really realistic. The label, and I think it's a label, quasi-appraisal,
Let me ask you on that scenario. So if, in it, hypothetically, if there was a different case where there was a risk of a net loss, then this remedy would be fine in your view?
No, Your Honor. It's as the court held in Weinberger, when there's a violation like this, quasi appraisal means the difference between the merger price, if any, was the exact quote, if any, used in Weinberger. And that's really the plaintiff's lawyer's risk. I mean, we're the ones litigating the case, and we're not going to be compensated if there's no difference. But again,
Mr. Terrell seems to be invoking the language at the end of Weinberger that says that no matter how you compute the economic award, keep in mind that you have the broad equitable powers of the historic Court of Chancery and you can do whatever is necessary to achieve a result, and that's what the Chancellor did in this case.
Well, first of all, it was summary judgment, but let me... I don't think that's what the Chancellor did. He viewed it as this is the remedy that I'm governed by this Gilliland case. This is now the remedy. And if that is the rule, this will be the remedy for every disclosure violation in every short-form merger. It is wrong. It's a legal error because we're not trying to give back to the minority what they lost. There was plenty of people who would not have demanded appraisal. We know that. I wouldn't stand up here and contend otherwise, even though it's an unfair price. They just don't do it. And so those people didn't lose anything. But that doesn't matter, in my view, legally, because that's not what the remedy that should be crafted should be directed at. It's whether people would have lost something or not, whether they would have demanded appraisal or not, the fiduciary doesn't get to keep the bonus, the difference between the merger price and fair value. So really, it's two sides of the same coin. The remedy looks like appraisal. That's why it's called quasi-appraisal. But what you're doing is saying there's a fiduciary violation and a statutory one, too. So we're going to take from you what you gain from this transaction. And that's not really punitive. It's simply saying we're going to treat this as if you're going to have to pay the price you would have had to pay if this were an actual arm's-length transaction, taking the benefit from you. And so I thought that was the reasoning for Neble. I thought that was the reasoning in Wacht, and I didn't think there was any dispute about that. And then Gilliland came along and had a very, quirky set of facts, and it was a technical case. And now things have come around, and now it's all quasi-appraisal means give everybody the chance to demand appraisal again. Labels are causing confusion, at least for me, with this quasi-appraisal label. What we're saying is the remedy for the violations in this case, the failure to comply with the appraisal statute and the failure to discharge your duty of disclosure, should be the payment of the difference between the merger price and fair value. Now, that looks like an appraisal, but what you're really trying to do is not recreate appraisal. You're just trying to take that difference from the controlling shareholder that didn't discharge its obligations in the transaction. There was a reference to, there's no intent to deceive here. I never thought that was, I don't think there was any evidence in Weinberger that the Arledge-Chaitia report was deliberately not put in, that they knew that it was supposed to be disclosed and they didn't disclose it. And so I don't think that's really relevant at this point in time. But I will say we did get here today in a somewhat unusual way, and I'll just recite it quickly. This case was filed. The defendants moved to dismiss it, which seemed somewhat incredible to me. So we countermoved, saying, no, there's not, the appraisal statute wasn't attached, and the required disclosure wasn't made. Then there was a countermotion for summary judgment saying, okay, well, if there's a violation, the remedy needs to be this, the remedy that was actually imposed. And so there wasn't any record developed here. It started with a motion to dismiss, and then there was a final ruling that this is the appropriate remedy. So to me, the trial court wasn't in a better position than this court to decide what the remedy should be. There was no evidence taken. It was just a finding that these were the violations, and this is the remedy that automatically flows from those violations, which was an incorrect ruling in our view. Unless Your Honors have any other questions.
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Rise.